And at that time when I put him down, she just jumps up and goes towards the center console, towards my gun.
The city of Vancouver in Washington is nestled in the Pacific Northwest. It sits across the Columbia River from Portland, Oregon, offering a blend of scenic beauty and urban convenience. The city is rich in history, and its roots as a fur trading outpost in the 19th century are preserved at the Fort Vancouver National Historic Site. Since it's economically robust, it serves as a hub for multiple industries, from technology and manufacturing to healthcare. In the summer months, Vancouver bursts with vitality, its parks and green spaces sprawling with life. As the sun sets, the city's nightlife comes alive, with clubs and bars buzzing into the late hours, while festivals such as the Wine and Jazz Festival and the Arts Music Festival ignite the streets with energy. However, on the 5th of June 2019, the city's typical summer scene took an unexpected turn. Despite the preceding days of high temperatures and endless sunshine, Vancouver was suddenly engulfed by a rainstorm. Seeking shelter from the downpour, 17-year-old Nikki Kuhnhausen found herself at a friend's home that night, accompanied by a few girlfriends. She had been crashing at her friend's place near 4th Plain Boulevard for a few weeks now, and on that particular night she showed up carrying a bottle of vodka and draped in a man's coat. Nikki, who was usually the life of the party, seemed unusually quiet. She was preoccupied with her cell phone, tapping out messages to a man on Snapchat that her friends didn't recognize. She mentioned that he was an older Russian she had met earlier downtown. Nikki said they had shared a drink, and he had kindly lent her his coat and gave her a bottle of vodka. As dawn approached the next morning, around 5:30 a.m., Nikki announced she was heading out to meet the Russian man again. Slipping into his coat, she bid her friends farewell and set off on foot into the breaking day. Nikki Kuhnhausen was born in Vancouver, Washington, on the 6th of July, 2001. She had been assigned male at birth, but even as a young child, she knew that she was different from her classmates. While boys in her class wanted to be football stars or mechanics, Nikki wanted to be Nicki Minaj's hair and makeup artist. She had always been a confident girl, especially in herself, so when she came out publicly in the 6th grade, nobody was really surprised. With newfound clarity, Nikki began to explore her gender identity more deeply, questioning the expectations that society had placed upon her. As she developed into a teenage girl, she experimented with different ways of expressing herself, trying on clothes and hairstyles that felt more aligned with her true sense of self. It was a journey of self-discovery and self-acceptance, and Nikki eventually came out as transgender. She had unwavering support from her family, with her mother Lisa and stepfather Vince standing firmly by her side. Nikki's impact on those around her was profound. She served as a pillar of support for everybody she encountered. Her pride in her identity served as a beacon of inspiration for fellow transgender students at her high school. One afternoon, a transgender girl transferred to Hudson Bay School. Nikki immediately took her under her wing after witnessing one of the boys picking on her. She never hesitated to engage with curious peers about her identity, viewing such moments as opportunities for education. Her mother Lisa remarked,
"She just radiated love. She came in contact with a lot of people and made a difference in their life. She made a difference.
Very colorful.
And it was all ages, all communities, all walks of life, the homeless, the CEOs, she could fit in anywhere. and bring something to the situation that left them feeling good about themselves. If somebody was hungry, she would go make sure they had food. If somebody needed a place to stay, she'd make sure she stayed with them till they found a place to lay their head. She was always concerned about other people. She was very loyal, and people loved her.
At school, Nikki effortlessly navigated the popular crowd, always finding time to assist the cheerleaders with their hair and makeup.
Anyway, she had been Nikki behind closed doors since she was 2 years old, and she had Hannah Montana and high heels and makeup, and we would buy her girls' clothes for her bedroom, and she would be on the track team, you know, in elementary school. But the first day of sixth grade, she came out Nikki, and she was Nikki ever since, and she was full of confidence, and people were drawn to her. The cheerleaders loved her. They thought she was so beautiful, so nobody on the football team bullied her, because then the cheerleaders would be mad at them. She had friends and support, and she was so confident in who she was.
She consistently championed the underdog, extending a helping hand whenever somebody needed support. A friend from the homeless community, Pink, credited Nikki with helping her overcome heroin addiction and regain control of her life. Reflecting on Nikki's generosity, Pink recalled, "Nikki was so kind and generous. She would constantly make sure that everybody downtown had food and water."
She didn't feel threatened by people because she was so giving and so nice and so there for the underdog. And, you know, she would take off her coat to give to a homeless man. She was there for everyone. She was there for me for 17 years. She was my light. She was my best cheerleader. And because of her, I'm sitting here today. She loved me unconditionally. She never left my side.
Nikki's creativity thrived, particularly in her passion for designing her own clothing. She was also an avid dancer, and her friends could always count on her to put a smile on their faces. One of her close friends, Taylor, recollected, "She was so bright. Everything was a smile. Even if she was just coming up to you, she was always smiling." Like many teenagers, Nikki embraced social media. She regularly updated her friends and followers with selfies and found validation in the flurry of likes that she received. On TikTok, she posted lip sync and dance videos to her thousands of followers. However, at the age of 16, Nikki fell into a dark spiral and began to experiment with drugs. What began as casual marijuana use escalated into a dangerous addiction to methamphetamine. Despite Lisa's relentless efforts to help her daughter overcome her addiction, Nikki's substance abuse had consumed her life by 2018. One night, Lisa received a phone call from a detective, informing her that Nikki had been shot 6 times. Racing to the hospital, fearing the worst, Lisa was astonished to find Nikki sitting in a wheelchair, seemingly unfazed, adorned with a full face of makeup and taking selfies. Miraculously, none of the gunshots had struck vital organs. The shooting had stemmed from a drug-related dispute, yet the shooter was never apprehended. Lisa hoped that this near-death experience would serve as a wake-up call for Nikki, compelling her to turn her life around before it was too late. After Nikki left her friend's home in the early morning hours of the 6th of June, she failed to return. Initially, her absence was dismissed as another one of Nikki's whims. Perhaps she had met a man and was staying in his apartment. Another possibility was that she was scoring drugs somewhere and had lost track of time. Arielle Fox, one of Nikki's closest friends, shrugged it off with a nonchalant remark, labelling it as a classic Nikki move. Yet beneath this facade of casual dismissal, a chilling apprehension lingered among her friends and family. Because of Nikki's turbulent history, there were fears that she might have fallen victim to a fatal overdose and was lying dead somewhere. when Lisa checked her daughter's social media and saw that Nikki hadn't posted. This only added to the growing dread that something had happened. When Lisa checked her daughter's social media, she saw that Nikki hadn't posted. This only added to the growing dread that something bad had happened. While Nikki had vanished before, the prolonged absence only added to Lisa's concerns, and she reported her daughter missing.
And when she didn't answer my messages on June 6th, I knew something was wrong. I clocked in at 2 and she hadn't answered my messages. It'd been all morning. At 4 o'clock on my first break, no response. At lunch, I knew in my stomach something was wrong. On the 10th, I filed a missing persons report. The policeman excused himself because he got a call on his walkie. And he came back and he asked me if I'd ever heard of a place called The Compound on 63rd Street. I said, no, what's that? Well, that was a detective Vice from sex trafficking and prostitution, and he recognized Nikki's name on the missing persons radio as being red flagged from there. I said, what does that mean, red flagged? Well, she'd been picked up from there many times, so her name's red flagged. And she wasn't arrested? No, she was underage. We took her home. I go, how long has this been going on? Well, the first one was 8 months ago. I go, well, you didn't bring her home to me, so where did you take her? Well, she said her mom lived in Clackamas. We took her out there. Yeah, so you dropped my minor daughter off at someone and you didn't ID them? Because you never brought her home to her mother. Because I'll tell you what, Nikki representing herself in that world as a girl and not telling the truth would get her killed. I knew that. I tried to get through. I had no idea she was in that industry. I had no idea we had a sex trafficking industry in Vancouver. I lived a very sheltered life. I had no clue.
After hearing that Nikki might have been involved in sex work, Lisa was stunned. There were now multiple scenarios running through her head, each one as grim as the other. With the official report filed, Nikki's loved ones rallied together. They mobilized and flooded the streets with posters adorned with Nikki's image, pleading for any sliver of information from the public. Simultaneously, they launched a digital crusade, setting up a Facebook page to aid in the search. Despite their relentless pursuit, Nikki remained elusive.
I didn't know if she was being held against her will in the sex trafficking industry and drugged and made to do things that were horrible. I didn't know if she was being shipped to another country.
During the investigation, Nikki's friends informed detectives that she had been communicating with a man on Snapchat that night. Intrigued, the detectives decided to delve into Nikki's Snapchat activity, hoping it would reveal the identity of this mysterious man. Their search led them to David Bogdanov, and Nikki had arranged for him to pick her up from her friend's home in the early morning hours. Despite their efforts to contact him, the detectives hit dead ends. They visited his apartment, his workplace, left cards and made numerous phone calls, all to no avail. Even attempts to reach out to Bogdanov via Snapchat messages went unanswered. Frustrated but undeterred, the detectives decided to broaden their scope, and they reached out to Bogdanov's brother, Stanislav. The family was originally from Russia, but they had settled down in the United States, where they operated a construction business together. According to Stanislav, on the night that Nikki disappeared, they had encountered her in downtown Vancouver. David Bogdanov had initiated a conversation with her as she walked alone. They shared some vodka and then exchanged Snapchat details. However, after that night, Stanislav hadn't seen or heard from his brother or Nikki. Curiously, Bogdanov had failed to show up for a tile job he was supposed to assist Stanislav with the next morning. As the investigation unfolded, it became clear that both Nikki and Bogdanov were now missing, sparking concerns that Nikki might be held against her will somewhere. It wasn't until late September that detectives finally made contact with David Bogdanov. He claimed to have experienced issues with his cell phone, explaining the delay in responding to messages. Following their communication, detectives requested Bogdanov to attend a routine interview at the police station, where he met with Detective David Jensen. During the interview, Bogdanov reiterated the account previously shared by his brother. He affirmed that they had encountered Nikki walking alone and offered her a ride to her friend's home.
I offered her my jacket because it was really cold outside. I said, do you want some vodka? Because I got some if you want to have a drink just to relax a little bit. And she said, sure. So I just gave her that bottle to take with her. I did give her my Snapchat name. I wanted to just exchange Snapchats, and she didn't have a phone with her.
Bogdanov recounted offering Nikki his coat due to the cold weather and said that he gave her a bottle of vodka. According to Bogdanov, they had maintained communication through Snapchat, eventually arranging for him to pick her up again that night. They proceeded to his brother's home, but he said that they remained in the van outside, engaging in conversation.
Kind of just parked there in the driveway, chit-chatting a little bit, and then she told me that she's not a she. I was shocked to find that out, and just uncomfortable and really, really disturbed. And I asked her to please get out of the car because this is just really weird for me. She just got out of the car and I took off.
Bogdanov said he felt uncomfortable upon learning that Nikki was transgender, citing cultural views that deem homosexuality unacceptable in Russia. Bogdanov said that he was disturbed and ordered Nikki out of the van.
For me, it's even disturbing when I'm around a gay person or somebody bi or transsexual or something, you know. So I just got disgusted and I asked her to just get out.
He said that she got out and walked away, and he never saw her again.
I wish I could help you more, but I don't know. I'm not a kind of person to... I'm not even a violent person, you know, at all, nothing.
According to Bogdanov's account, following his encounter with Nikki, he proceeded to drive to his workplace in Portland. Naturally, detectives remained suspicious of Bogdanov, given that he was the last known person to have seen Nikki. However, lacking concrete evidence, they were compelled to release him from custody without charge. Undeterred, detectives persisted in their investigation and obtained additional search warrants, focusing particularly on Bogdanov's phone records, specifically his cell phone location data. Despite Bogdanov's assertion during his interview that he had gone directly to work after parting ways with Nikki, the records revealed a contradictory narrative. They indicated that he had driven to the vicinity of Larch Mountain and then returned to his brother's home approximately an hour and 25 minutes later. The area where Bogdanov's cell phone had registered activity was expansive and rugged, posing significant challenges in pinpointing his exact whereabouts. Despite multiple excursions to the area by detectives, finding any trace of Nikki proved akin to searching for a needle in a haystack. Undeterred by the daunting task, detectives remained steadfast in their pursuit of both answers and Nikki's whereabouts. However, as day stretched into weeks and weeks into months, the passage of time only intensified the urgency of their investigation, while simultaneously deepening the mystery surrounding Nikki's disappearance. Larch Mountain is located in Clark County, Washington, and comprises dense woodland, mostly Douglas fir, western red cedar, and hemlock trees. It's got an elevation of over 4,000 feet, which offers panoramic vistas of the surrounding landscape, but it's very remote. On the morning of the 7th of December, a man was looking for bear grass, a type of grass that is characterized by its long, slender leaves and tall, flowering stalks. The grass holds significant cultural and traditional importance for indigenous people of the region, and it's used in traditional ceremonies, basket weaving, and crafting. The man had a keen eye for the prized plant, and as he navigated the rugged landscape, something in the near distance caught his eye. Curiosity got the better of him, so he decided to investigate. When he got closer to the item, he found that it was a human skull weathered by time and the elements. The man stopped in his tracks and took a few minutes to make sure that what he was seeing was indeed a human skull, and not some kind of animal. The size and shape of the eye sockets, the curve of the jawbone, and the contours of the nasal cavity all pointed towards it being a human. Deputy Timothy Gosh was on patrol in the North County area when he received the report from the man. The man led Deputy Gosh to a difficult-to-reach location, where a human skull was indeed discovered. Nearby, Deputy Gosh observed a woman's shoe, a jacket, underwear, and a bandana, all of which matched the clothing Nikki had been wearing when she was last seen by her friends. After 6 agonizing months, Nikki had finally been found. Upon arrival, forensic experts cordoned off the area and began their examination. Not too far from the skull, they discovered hair extensions entangled with a phone charger. Among the hair, they also found a hyoid bone. The remains were carefully transported to the medical examiner's office, where it was determined that Nikki had been asphyxiated with the phone charger.
Lads, do you enjoy getting traumatised on a weekly basis? Well, neither does my co-host Neil.
People call me a victim more than a co-host.
Anyway, welcome to the Mortal Musings podcast. I'm your host, Megan. Each week, we dive into some truly dark and disturbing cases. Do you ever find yourself listening to these horrific tales and saying to yourself,
huh? No.
Huh?
Well, the actual f***? Why? Why did he do that? Solved it, mate. There's no need for that. They're just acting the b***s.
Our episodes include cases of serial killers, the story of a socialite that was held captive for 25 years, prison riots, wrongful executions, and scandals in the death industry. At the end of each episode, we throw in a tale of oddity. Anything from medical mishaps to the real-life Weekend at Bernie's or Mike the Headless Chicken. New episodes every Wednesday. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
And remember, here at the Mortal Musings podcast, we like to take the cases seriously, but not ourselves.
The detectives held a press conference that evening.
We caught probably the biggest break when a citizen on December 7th of this year, walking in the Large Mountain area, came across a human skull. Clark County deputies arrived and confirmed the findings and called out Clark County Search and Rescue. They conducted an extensive search of the area over 2 days and collected a number of items of evidence and human remains. It should be noted that that area is extremely steep, heavily wooded, and a lot of underbrush, and they really did an amazing job of collecting all that evidence for us. Over the next week, analysis was done on those items along with the forensic examination of the remains, and with that information, we were able to confirm the remains to be Nikki Kuhnhauser.
A murder investigation was promptly initiated, with detectives focusing their attention on their prime suspect, David Bogdanov. He was apprehended and taken to the police station for further questioning.
When we spoke to you last time, I don't know if you recall the whole conversation, but you said that you met her earlier in the evening, met her downtown, hung out with her for a while, drank some vodka together, you gave her a coat, and then she went home and then you met her again later. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah.
Okay. And what you told us at the time was that you and Stan went back to Archer's house up there at 114th, and you needed your van because you're going to go to work, and Stan needed to take his van to his job, right? And at that time was when Nikki told you that Nikki was really a he,
mm-hmm.
And that's when you're like, I'm not into this, and kicked her out of the van, sent her on her way, okay? Then after that, you said that you went So you said you were going to go to...
I went to work.
Stan's... You said you were going to go to Stan's job site.
No, I went to my other brother.
Okay. Oh, your other brother. Is it Archer's job site?
Ely.
Ely. Okay. So you're going to go to his job site, but then you ended up... You're going to go to your job site, but you ended up just staying at his job site.
Yeah, I was confusing. I don't remember. It was busy day.
It sounded like you said that you were going to go to your job site.
Basically, I went to work.
Yeah, you went to work.
Detective David Jensen was aware of Bogdanov's presence in the Larch Mountain area around the time that Nikki disappeared, and he pressed him for information.
What got us here today is I want to talk to you about a trip that you took before you went to the job site.
So before we go on, he's basically summarized everything that you guys talked about.
Is there anything about that?
Is there anything that you want to revise before we continue on?
I mean, I might have stopped by the gas station.
Okay.
I don't remember.
So at the time that we talked, I didn't have the benefit of all of your phone records, okay? But now there's been some initial analysis done. Okay. So you left, your phone left Archer's house and then went east out past Larch Mountain. What happened on that trip? That trip took about an hour round trip from Archer's house past Larch Mountain, up some logging roads, and then back again.
However, Bogdanov chose to remain silent and requested a lawyer. Despite his silence, the evidence amassed against him was deemed sufficient to obtain an arrest warrant.
So understand that you're being arrested today for the murder of Nikki Kutnasa, whose remains have been discovered, okay? Who was strangled to death.
Subsequently, David Bogdanov was formally charged with second-degree murder. Detectives held a press conference to announce his arrest, during which they presented their theory of the events leading to Nikki's murder.
The information we have is leads us to believe that they had a kind of a hookup meeting and that it wasn't targeting Nikki for a particular reason, that it arose probably from the hookup meeting.
According to their account, Bogdanov had intended to engage in sexual activity with Nikki. However, when he learned that she was transgender, he reacted with anger, allegedly resulting in him strangling her to death. This narrative prompted speculation regarding potential hate crime charges against Bogdanov, although detectives clarified during the press conference that such decisions would be up to the prosecution. Lieutenant Tom Ryan further stated, "We would love the community to know we take all of these cases seriously. Whenever we have a case with a person in a group that is sometimes targeted because of their personas or beliefs and lifestyles, then we tend to bump that up on our concern levels." The community called for the charges to be upgraded and for Bogdanov to be charged with a hate crime. Nikki's mother, Lisa, was at the forefront of the movement, commenting, "She didn't deserve this, that hatred, the last thing she felt on earth. Yes, she was murdered out of hatred because she was transgender." It's a common fact that transgender people face high rates of violence and discrimination. When transgender people go missing, they're most often found dead. They are disproportionately targeted for violent attacks, even including murder, and the epidemic of violence is fueled by a combination of prejudice, ignorance, and systemic discrimination. According to a recent UCLA Law School study, transgender people are 4 times more likely than non-transgender people to become victims of violent crime. In 2019, there have been countless attacks against transgender individuals in the United States, and Nikki was the 23rd transgender person to be killed that year. In 2018, Washington ranked as the second nationwide for most hate crimes, with 666 reported. California was first, with over 1,000 reported. However, detectives later shared that they didn't think that the charges would be upgraded because they didn't believe that it was a targeted killing. Advocates disagreed, with Michelle Bart, president and co-founder of the Vancouver-based National Women's Coalition Against Violence and Exploitation, stating, "Although investigators cannot show premeditation, we believe there was a hate crime, and Nikki had no chance whatsoever, whether she was LGBTQ, even a woman for that matter. On the 20th of December, Nikki's loved ones gathered at the Vancouver United Church of Christ to pay tribute to her. In a deeply emotional moment, her mother Lisa tearfully addressed the crowd. My fears and my visions and nightmares were true stories. For 6 months I prayed that wasn't what was happening. Despite the agony, Lisa celebrated Nikki's life, describing her as a beacon of love who touched countless hearts and made a positive impact on everyone she encountered. The overwhelming support, especially from the transgender community, deeply moved Lisa. They vowed to ensure that Nikki's memory would endure, offering solace in their promise never to forget her name. This sentiment reverberated throughout the memorial, echoed by the mayor, who urged, "Please remember to say her name." In a later memorial, Nikki's family spoke some more. Her brother Conrad stated, "The one thing I hope everyone can take away from this is to be yourself. Be who you were made to be. Don't give up." Lisa said that she still couldn't talk about her daughter in the past tense, and that she hadn't accepted that she was gone forever. Nikki's stepfather, Vince Woods, said that he was having a really hard time coming to terms with what had happened.
Last 6 months has been the longest 6 months of our lives. It's just been a roller coaster ride up and down, playing in our minds what has happened, where is she? People have been awesome with their, putting out flyers and all the work. A lot of people put a lot of hard work, trying to bring her home.
Early the next year, Bogdanov appeared in court, where he was charged with a hate crime. Judge David Gregerson ordered him to be held on $750,000 bail, much lower than the $6 million bail requested by the prosecution. The judge had set the lower amount because Bogdanov had no prior criminal history. Then the following month, a bill was approved, limiting the so-called panic defense. This is a legal strategy in which a defendant claims that their violent actions were a response to a sudden and intense feeling of fear or panic. This defense is often used in hate crimes and is used to excuse or justify acts of violence against LGBTQ+ individuals, especially transgender people, by portraying their mere existence or expression of identity as a legitimate trigger for panic and fear. House Bill 1687, which was named the Nikki Kuhnhausen Act, would block a defendant from using a panic defense based on discovery or disclosure of the victim's actual or perceived gender or sexual orientation. More specifically, the bill would prevent a claim of diminished responsibility because the defendant did not fully comprehend the nature and gravity of the alleged crime. Representative Sharon Wiley commented, "What this bill does, it removes a possible defense for the kind of thing that happened to Nikki. Nikki was strangled by somebody who was upset about who she was." Lisa testified at the Senate committee, urging the bill to pass.
"I knew something was wrong the night I didn't get my call. My daughter, Nikki Kuhnhausen, went missing in June of 2019, and her remains were found in December of 2018. Nikki was murdered by a person who found out she was transgender and responded violently by taking her life. Bill 1687 would remove the ability to claim diminished capacity and use force based on the discovery of a victim's gender identity. Now this bill is not going to bring my daughter back, but what I hope is it will keep other families from experiencing the same kind of pain they feel. Thank you for your time, and I ask that you pass House Bill number 1687.
Thank you very much for sharing your story."
The bill passed on a 46-3 vote, and on the 6th of March, Washington banned the use of gay or transgender panic as a legal defense. They became the 10th state to ban the defense, following California, Connecticut, Hawaii, Illinois, Maine, Nevada, New Jersey, New York, and Rhode Island. Following this, Bogdanov's bail was increased to $2 million. This had come after it was discovered that on the day that Nicky was killed, he had purchased a one-way ticket to Ukraine. The reason detectives couldn't get a hold of him after he was identified as a person of interest wasn't because his cell phone had broken, but because he had fled the country. He stayed in Ukraine until the 15th of July, when he returned to the United States. The jury selection for the murder trial began in August of 2021. The prospective jurors were asked questions about perceptions of LGBTQ plus people, Russian people, the use of the Fifth Amendment protection against self-incrimination, and self-defense. By the 18th of that month, a jury had been selected, and opening statements began. Senior Deputy Prosecutor Colin Hayes was the first to take the floor before the jury. He walked jurors through that night in June of 2019, telling them how Nicky and Bogdanov had met in downtown Vancouver. During the opening statements of defense attorney Aaron McAleer, Bogdanov's new defense became apparent. While he had first of all completely denied killing Nicky, during the opening statements his defense attorney admitted that he killed her. However, she said that it wasn't out of prejudice, but instead to stop her from attacking or potentially killing Kim. Prosecutor Hayes rebuffed this defense and pointed out that Bogdanov was much taller and heavier than Nicky. He further said that after his arrest, Bogdanov was recorded in a jailhouse phone call, using Russian slang that translates to a derogatory term for members of the LGBTQ plus community. The testimony got underway promptly, with Bogdanov's brothers testifying about the night Nicky disappeared. His former girlfriend also told the jury that she had known him to make derogatory comments about people he suspected were gay, bisexual, or transgender. Building on this, a court-certified translator and Vancouver police officer testified that Bogdanov had used a Russian anti-gay slur when talking with family while in jail. Evidence was then presented about Bogdanov's meeting with Nicky, and the evidence collected from his cell phone. It showed that they had been together that night, and then the next morning Bogdanov's cell phone showed that he had spent an hour and a half in the area where Nicky's body was found. After that, Bogdanov searched Kiev flights and then purchased a one-way ticket. The prosecution's case was short, since Bogdanov had now admitted that he actually did kill Nicky. They just wanted to show that he was motivated by hatred of people in the LGBTQ plus community, not self-defense. The defense then began their case by calling Bogdanov to the witness stand. His defense attorney asked him some questions about his beliefs and his upbringing.
Yes, I was born and raised into Christianity, and in the last maybe 8 years, kind of transitioned into Christian Jewish, and just been going to church my whole life, pretty much.
Do you have certain views of the LGBT community based on your religious or cultural upbringing?
Yes. Yeah, I was taught that it is a sin, and it's not okay, but as well as other sins.
Okay. Does this belief mean that you hate LGBTQ members or community people?
No, it doesn't mean that.
Why not?
Because we are all human. We all have things that we do, and I'm not nobody to hate on one person, on another person that does one thing, you know. I have my own things to deal with.
The defense attorney then mentioned his ex-girlfriend's comments.
The state offered testimony through your girlfriend, or your ex-girlfriend, Anessa, where they talked about you and her in the mall, where she said that you observed either a gay couple or heterosexual, something, or gay, bisexual, or transsexual couple. And you remarked to her that it was disgusting. Is that right?
Yeah.
What exactly was disgusting?
Nothing that I can really remember of from that moment, except it probably might have been, had to have been something like, I probably saw some two men kissing or something like that, which would have prompted me to say in private to my girl, "Oh, that's disgusting."
Okay, so do you find homosexual activity disgusting then?
Yeah.
The testimony then shifted to the night that Nikki disappeared.
I was in the car. I was in the van with my brother Arthur. We were just smoking a cigarette, waiting on Stan to come down from the apartment. And we're just sitting in the car parked on the road and saw Nikki walking across the street by herself.
Okay, did you approach her?
Yes, I did. I told my brother to wait in the car, and I went and approached Nikki by myself.
Okay, so when you first appeared to approach Nikki, how did she appear to you at that point?
She seemed a little emotionally off, maybe upset. And I was trying to talk to her. She just, it was as if she was just like looking right through me. You know, we're looking at each other, but she's like looking past me almost as if.
Bogdanov described meeting Nikki that night after he had been drinking with his brothers. Later that night, he picked her up and they drove over to his brother's house. He said that they drove there so that he could switch into his own car, an Audi A8L. They switched into the car, and Bogdanov said that Nikki moved to the back seat.
I came back, and I opened my driver's door and saw that Nikki was moved to the back seat now, in the back of the car.
Okay, and what was Nikki doing at that point?
She was smoking something out of a pipe. I wasn't gonna make a big deal out of it. I didn't really like that she was smoking that in my car.
And why weren't you gonna make a big deal about it?
Because I was anticipating, thought that we're just gonna, you know, hook up probably, and I'm just gonna drop her off.
Okay, and did you get in the front or the back of the car?
I eventually got in the back. She invited me to come sit in the back with her.
Bogdanov explained to the jury that they chatted in the back seat for a while.
That transitioned into us making out.
Okay, and so by making out, what do you mean?
Exchange of saliva.
So kissing?
Yes.
With tongue?
Yes.
Is there touching or anything else?
Yes.
Okay. Who was touching who?
It was a little bit of both at first.
Where was she touching you?
Her. She started touching me in my private area.
Okay.
Bogdanov said that he then removed his trousers.
She engages in giving me oral sex. I reach over as she's bent over. I reach over and put my hand in her pants.
Okay. Can you kind of tell me about that? What do you feel when you put your hands in her pants?
I worked around the layers of clothing and felt what was clearly balls and penis.
According to Bogdanov, he pushed Nikki away from him and began swearing at her and ordered her out of the car.
I freak out and I push her back towards the passenger's door and I just start freaking out, saying, "I'm sorry if I cuss, but I was saying, you know, what the fuck? What is this? You didn't tell me you're a dude."
Bogdanov explained that he was humiliated, and that he would have been shunned if his family found out. According to Bogdanov, Nikki started fighting with him after he pushed her into the passenger door. He claimed that Nikki then reached towards the front seat, where he had a loaded handgun tucked away. He described attempting to pull Nikki back away from the gun. He said she knew there was a gun there because he had told her earlier that he always carried a gun so that she wouldn't freak out, and that he had a concealed carry permit for it.
And at that time, when I put him down, she just jumps up and goes towards the center console, towards my gun.
Okay. What do you thinking at this point when she jumps or springs towards the center console and you think you're going at her console and you think she's going for your gun? What's going through your mind?
I'm thinking, you know, I just was deceived by this person into oral sex, and this person's high on meth. She's jumping for my gun. At this point, the overwhelming feeling and thought was like a fight or flight mode just kicks in.
Bogdanov described fearing for his life if Nikki got her hands on the gun. He said that she elbowed him and tried to claw at his face, and that he struggled to get a grip on the jacket that she was wearing.
In the passenger seat, the front passenger seat in the rear pocket, was hanging out my phone cord, my charging cable, and in that struggle, I grabbed that cable and put it around her, and so I can hold on to it and pull her back like that, and hold her from going forward for the gun.
He alleged that he wrapped a phone charger around her shoulder area, but during the struggle, the cord slipped around her neck. Bogdanov told the jury that once Nikki stopped moving, he removed the charger. He claimed he believed that she had only passed out. Bogdanov said that he then grabbed the gun and put it in the trunk of the car, and then came back to check on Nikki.
I came back around to check up on Nikki, and she wasn't waking up, and I started. I try to check if she's breathing, you know.
Was she?
No.
Bogdanov testified that he was too afraid to call the police. He didn't think that they would believe him because he had been drinking. He said that there were drugs in the car as well, but said that these belonged to Nikki. Bogdanov maintained that he didn't mean to kill Nikki, he just wanted to get her out of the car and get her away from the loaded gun. He then decided he needed to get rid of Nikki's body and thought of Larch Mountain. He'd been shooting there before, so he drove over there with Nikki's body in the back seat. He pulled up along a steep hillside and pushed Nikki's body out of the car. Later that day, he booked a one-way ticket to Ukraine, telling the jury that he was an emotional wreck. According to Bogdanov, he had called a friend to get rid of his car and said he had no idea where the car was, nor the gun that was allegedly inside it. Under cross-examination by Prosecutor Hayes, he pointed out the differences in their size.
Is it true that with your size and strength advantage, you knew you would be able to overpower Nikki in a physical altercation?
I didn't know that I'd be able to overpower her, but I was definitely trying to keep her away from the gun. And I'll say, thank goodness I have the strength, because otherwise it might have been different if I wasn't a strong person.
So you are a strong person, right?
By some standards.
You moved Nikki's body on your own, right?
Yes.
The prosecutor then asked Bogdanov about his interviews with detectives. He never once mentioned anything about self-defense or any violent altercation with Nikki. Bogdanov said that he hadn't said anything, claiming that he was too afraid that it wouldn't be believed. After Bogdanov testified, the defense rested their case. He was the sole witness for their entire case. The crux of the case truly hinged on whether or not the jury believed him. During closing arguments, Deputy Prosecutor Kristen Arnold pointed out inconsistencies in Bogdanov's testimony. She said that he had used more force than was necessary, or that a reasonable person would use when he strangled Nikki with the phone cord. She argued that his testimony showed the thought going through his head as Nicky fought back was that he had been deceived, not that he was fearful. She also said that he lied multiple times to detectives and pointed out that he never told them that he was defending himself from Nicky. Defense attorney Matthew Hoff touched on this during his closing arguments. He said that Bogdanov didn't tell the truth because he didn't want people to know that he had sexual contact with a transgender woman. He said that Bogdanov had pushed Nicky away and cursed at her because he didn't consent to having sexual contact with her. He stated, "That's not a primary aggressor. That's someone reacting how most people would react under the same situation." The jury were then sent off to deliberate, but there was a problem some hours later. The jury expressed concern to the court about potential juror misconduct. They said that they had reached a verdict on one count, but were deadlocked on the other. In the notes that were passed to the court, they said that one juror appeared to be basing her decision on personal views, and not on the facts of the case. By the next day, however, they had reached a unanimous verdict. They found David Bogdanov guilty of second-degree murder and hate crime. As the verdict was announced, Nicky's family quietly celebrated from the public gallery, but Bogdanov showed no semblance of emotion. In a Facebook post that evening, the Justice for Nicky group applauded the jury's findings. They wrote, "The long build-up to this trial and the defense's attempts to somehow paint Nicky, who was a 17-year-old girl, as being responsible for the defendant's violent actions, were excruciating for us, and particularly for Nicky's mother, Lisa. There's no excuse for what happened to Nicky. This hate crime wounded our community." After the verdict, Bogdanov returned to court on the 29th of August for the sentencing phase. He took his place alongside his defense team while Nicky's mother sat in the public gallery. She was clutching a stuffed animal that her daughter used to sleep with. The prosecution were seeking the maximum sentence allowed, while the defense wanted just 11 years. Judge David Gregerson addressed Bogdanov. He became very emotional as he described how he was struck by the darkness of the case. He further noted that there was an element of predation in the case, because Nicky was only 17 years old, whereas David Bogdanov was 25, and he had provided her with alcohol. He stated, "Everyone in this courtroom has been 17 at some point in their lives. She could have been anyone's son or daughter." The judge then sentenced David Bogdanov to 20 years in prison. In a world where acceptance and understanding often falter, transgender people navigate a perilous path, fraught with danger, particularly from the hands of violent men. Simply living their truth becomes an act of bravery as they face the grim reality of hate crimes, discrimination, and physical assault solely for being who they are. Nicky Kuhnhausen was a proud transgender woman who had lived a difficult life. In the end, she found out the hard way that by simply existing, she was seen as a threat by a man clinging to narrow-minded ideologies. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening, and I'd like to say a massive thank you to my newest supporter up on Patreon, Lisa. In exchange for your support up on Patreon, I upload ad-free and early release episodes, bonus episodes of Morbidology Plus that aren't on the regular podcast platforms, behind the scenes, and I also send out a handwritten thank you card along with some cool merch. You can join me up on Patreon for as little as $1 a month, and there are absolutely no obligations. You can cancel your subscription at any time. Patreon really helps independent shows continue, and without it, Morbidology would really, really struggle. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.